Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Good morning. It's John Williams. How are you? We're here weekdays from 9 to noon on social media. WGN King John. Later in the show, we'll visit with the guy who's in charge of ATMs in the country. Not exactly that, but he's like an expert on ATM machines. You know how people have been ripping ATM machines off in Chicago and the area? And so we had a million questions about them yesterday. Somebody texted in the following intriguing idea, that the big bank ATM machines with a lot of money in them have shredders in them. And if you tip the machine over because you're stealing it, the money automatically gets shredded.
It's like a pinball machine tilt mechanism.
It's like it goes tilt. So I talked to the guy off the air about that today, and I said, really? He goes, I've never heard of that. And when somebody called that in, I thought, oh, that's such a good idea. I'll bet it's not true. But he said there are things to compromise the cash inside. Anyway, I've got questions about how ATM machines work, and we'll just go down that path in the 10 o'clock hour. It's National Vacation Planning Day. Friends of mine, Billy and Roberta King of Peoria, Illinois, posted a picture yesterday, and we were looking at it, and there they were all sitting around a map of Ireland planning a trip that they're going to take. What a fun activity that was, and Roberta said something I think is very true. She said, sometimes planning the vacation is as fun as the vacation itself. I've said that for years, that if you go for a week to Chicago or Florida or France, wherever you go, that's 1 week of fun. But if you plan it out a year ahead of time, you've got a whole year of anticipation and planning and shopping or thinking. Literally, it provides more than just the time that you're gone. A travel agent friend of ours will give us the five hottest travel trips this year. In the 10 o'clock hour, too, the Senate continues to debate the guilt or innocence, or hear the arguments about the guilt or innocence of President Donald Trump. There's an interesting story in the USA Today today, and it's about what the senators are doing. You notice how the camera is just on the speaker. Big debate is about this John Bolton guy. And maybe now the compromise will be each side gets one witness. So we'll get Bolton and you get Biden. Or we'll get this person and you get that person. It would seem to me like if it's good enough to have one witness, but two witnesses would shed even more light. I don't know why they limit the number of witnesses. To me, if you go down that path, go down that path. But anyway, the latest thought today is that each side would have one. Okay, maybe you would make that deal. But what are the senators doing off camera, because you don't see them? Okay, I'll tell you what they're doing in just a minute. Back into the WGN Radio newsroom we go first, though. Kind of a gray morning. Is some sunshine going to come our way, Steve?
I don't know, John. I'm busy planning my next vacation.
Where would it be? Where would Steve Krasanich go?
Seriously, this is funny because I've been looking at this place like it's the Montgomery Ward's Christmas catalog. I've been looking at this trip to the Aurora Borealis Observatory in Finland.
We have a saying at my house.
Yeah.
Everybody's got a thing. Mm. So that's your thing, huh? The Aurora Borealis.
Winter. Imagine a winter scene and the northern lights overhead.
Well, I wish. Is it possible, though, that you make the time and effort to go there and then that doesn't happen?
The thing about this place, they guarantee 90% of the year you get to see the northern lights.
What's the mountain people go to see in Alaska, and you go all the way up there, and then you take the inland cruise, and you go to see, was it Mount McKinley or whatever it is? And a lot of times it's fogged or clouded in, and you don't get to see it. You went all the way out there, and then you can't see the dang thing.
Yeah, is that the one with the big observatory on the top of it?
I think so. No one knows, because it's usually fogged in.
Yeah, it's the only place in Hawaii where it snows as well, I think, that's up there. But
do me this favor.
Yeah.
As you get ready to do the forecast. My number is 312-981-7200. What's your dream vacation? Destination? Maybe it's a little off the beaten path, too. For Steve Krasanich, it's to go to
Finland.
I'm not laughing. I'm not judging. We're not judging. Actually, we are a little bit. What's your dream location? for Dave Ennett, it would be the Baseball Hall of Fame in Yankston, Ohio.
Yankston, Ohio?
I don't know where it is. But
it's in Cooperstown, New York, but I've been many times.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, you get to stay in a little igloo with a glass ceiling in Finland.
We were talking about ATM thieves in Chicago. Somebody just texted in, stop saying ATM machine, John. Automatic or automated teller machine is a redundant redundancy. It's even worse than when someone says the Chicagoland area. It's an ATM. You don't need to say machine. I'm going to work on that. Good point. Hey, John, I'm a banking professional. There's no shredder in the bank ATM. And notice this banking professional did not say ATM machine. So I think we've all learned a little lot this morning. A little lot. Would be a little or a lot. Records relating to 250 million customers of a major software company spanning 14 years have reportedly been exposed from an unprotected database. Here we go again. Another commercial for LifeLock. But these stories are true, and you don't want to be one of them. Exposed records were service and support logs between agents and customers from around the world. They contain customer emails, IP addresses, among other items. These records could have been accessed by anyone with a web browser. It's important to understand how cybercrime is affecting you almost every day. You know, someone's identity is stolen every 2 seconds, and you could miss certain identity threats if you're just monitoring your credit on your own. And honestly, I don't even know how to do that. I've got LifeLock. I was so glad that I did. You know, I got a call from them right away, and they said, hey, there was some suspicious activity. There were court records that you need to be aware of. And I was really glad that they alerted me to something I didn't know about. But more importantly, maybe, it's just that each night when you go to bed, you know the front door is locked, the car is locked, and so too is your identity. All of this data. If there is a problem, then the folks at LifeLock work with you to fix it. No one can prevent all identity theft or monitor all transactions, but LifeLock can see threats you might miss. Join now and save up to 25% off your first year with the promo code LifeLock. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK or head to LifeLock.com and use the promo code LifeLock to save 25%. By the way, Dave, I was going to give this to you. Have a little something here for you.
Oh, thank you, John.
Just go ahead and read that on the radio.
A tense moment in recent history preserved in art, inspired by the Chicago school closings. How an artist is transforming the things left behind. That's tonight's cover story on WGN TV News at 9.
Denali, John, was renamed McKinley. Now renamed Denali again. Thanks for that. John, I have an unhealthy fascination with Reykjavik, Iceland. So that would be my dream travel destination, says Brett. I think that's a pretty hot spot. John, we went to that observatory in Hawaii, and it was magnificent. I have not done that. The Boundary Waters in Minnesota, I go every year. It is the best place on earth. Save the Boundary Waters. John, I want to ride my mountain bike through Canyonlands National Park in Utah, 100 miles off-road. Hey, Karen, you're on WGN. It's National Plan a Vacation Day. Karen, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to say?
I want to go to three places. I want to take an African safari, I want to go to Israel, and I want to dive the Great Barrier Reef.
That all sounds pretty good to me. Great Barrier Reef. You know, some of these things, it's sort of like the glaciers in Alaska. You want to do it while it's still there, or while it is
right.
As magnificent as it is now. So that's the Barrier Reef. Well, you wanted to go where in Israel, did you say?
Everywhere. I just want to see the birth of modern religion.
And then the third one was a safari in Africa.
Yes.
Now, are you going to shoot a camera or shoot a gun when you go on this safari?
The camera.
Yeah. You know, we're going to talk to Sue Kelly from Kelly Cruises a little later on, but I asked her once what her favorite all-time, and she's traveled the world professionally many times over. Her favorite thing to do, as I recall ever, was you're out on some plane in Africa, and you get in a hot air balloon at like 4:30 in the morning. The balloon goes up in the dark, and then when the sun comes up, you're hovering over the savanna or whatever, and you watch all of the animals emerge, and it's just quiet, and you're sort of, what a unique vantage point, right?
Right. I bet that would be amazing.
Yeah. All right, so you got to start it. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it, Karen.
No problem. Thank you.
Now just get yourself $19,000 and go on one of those things. Because you could always do a staycation. I've been a little disappointed with some of my staycations.
Really?
And living in Chicago, how could that be? But a lot of, I don't know, it just doesn't feel special.
You think too much pressure to really enjoy and being at home?
Yeah. It's funny because Dave and I, we all here at WGN Radio, work downtown. As we go to and from this building, particularly we were at the Tribune Tower across the river, we would go by people all day long whose dream it was to be in the spot we were. It was their vacation.
Yes.
They're looking up, taking pictures to all different languages. We should not take this great place for granted. Hey, Dave, you're on WGN. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, John. I wanted to just suggest, as a dream destination for my wife and I, the Montreux Jazz Festival in Switzerland.
Yeah.
We had the good fortune to be able to travel to Switzerland, and it was sort of by way of Switzerland we were going to the south of France. So I, as a place to fly into, we went into Geneva, but we stayed, you know, along the lake, and I was just totally blown away by how unbelievably gorgeous Lake Geneva is, and we had the good fortune to run on to, unbeknownst to us, a small jazz festival in a town called Cooey. We in America, of course, would pronounce it Cully. And it was, they've had this jazz festival for 34 years, but Montreux is the granddaddy of them all. Very expensive to go and, you know, form your way in with all the, you know, the world's richest folks. But it is just a spectacular place. We'd love to go.
So are you saying go to Cooey or go to the Montreux Jazz Fest?
Well, if you want something, I think, unique, Cooey is, we just were totally transported when we went there. It was just so fabulous. It's a tiny little town on the lake, very picturesque. And these are more emergent artists. We did see one guy that we saw many years ago at Ravinia, a guy named Jean-Louis Ponty. He was probably the headliner at the Cooey Jazz Festival, more than likely because he's like my age, 70-something. But anyway, it was great. Montreux is really the top-tier jazz talent in the world. So,
So I understand. By the way, Dave, you're 70 years old?
71, yeah.
I want to sound like you, and I'm 71 years old. I want to sound like you, and I'm 61 years old. You sound if you should limit your interaction to strangers on the phone because you could sell yourself as 41, sir.
All right. Well, thank you. Your mouth to God's ears.
You have a good day.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dave. John, my dream vacation is to go to Ireland, get snockered in an Irish pub, and pass out in a field of clover. I would die a happy man, signed Matt in Kenosha. See, this is what I'm looking for. That's just kind of once-in-a-lifetime experiences you've had or you pine for. Dave, is one there hanging out there for you?
Actually, place I've always wanted to go, you just mentioned, Alaska.
Yeah.
And I think I'm going.
Oh, well, are you doing that one with Steve, right? Or Nancy? Or are you just doing it on
your own? I believe with Nancy.
With Kelly Cruises?
I don't know if that's been announced yet, so.
All right, well then, don't say that on the radio.
I won't say it on the radio.
John, regarding ATMs, people say PIN number, and that's redundant too. There's a lot of unhappy people out there because I say ATM machine and PIN number all the time. What's your PIN number? But I could save a lot of time if I just said, hey, what's your PIN? And then you would say, it's none of your beeswax.
Correct.
Why am I giving you my PIN?
Yes.
Hi, John. The best vacation, hiking the Appalachian Long Trail and visiting the Fall Festival and Fairs in New England and staying at some of the best B&Bs. Appalachian Trail. I want to do that. I also want to be younger when I do.
Yeah, it's very demanding, and it takes a long time. I mean, I guess you don't have to do the entire trail.
Yeah, right.
That takes months.
Friends of ours. Their kids were hiking the trail, and they said, hey, come on out, Mom and Dad, for just a few days, a week. And the mom and dad are fit and nimble and of a mind to do that. And they got out there, and it rained on them It was not this idyllic with a walking stick nature. It was just, let's go crawl around up a hill in some mud for about 3 days.
And there are bears.
But on the upside, there's bears. That was their trip. Who else is on the line? Oh, yeah, Dan, you're on.
Turn it down if you...
Hey, Dan, this is John. You're on the air. Turn down those other radios. Now you're on. How are you?
John, how are you?
Good. What's up?
Good. Well, I have been around. My brother's been around the world a lot, too. He's a safari leader, explores world travels, so he's been around. I've never been on one of his safaris, but I was doing business in China and got to go to the Great Wall in a weekend by myself, and I made it there because I had this little piece of paper from the hotel with all of these directions to get back. I was scared to death I couldn't get back.
Yeah, right.
Got to the wall, fantastic. Met these two gentlemen from the Netherlands. One of them was a good hiker. We went up the wall, came down. All of the taxis were gone. All of the buses were gone. And the guy said, well, just take that path. It'll take you back to Bottleding, the railroad station. We start walking. One of the guys from Netherlands is totally drunk. And I said, how long have you guys been friends? The other guy said, I just met him on the train coming here. After we walked through a tunnel, a second tunnel, train tunnel, I said, I'm not doing this again.
Yeah.
And so we finally found a bus that right in the middle of the road stopped for the three of us.
Wow.
And we successfully got back to the train station.
I guess part of the best travel stories are when something goes wrong or unexpected, and then you have to navigate it. You're off the beaten path. And and hopefully you don't die in these stories.
That's right.
The train wasn't coming.
Part of the adventure. Yeah.
Thanks for the phone call. You have a good morning. It's 9:30. What are the top five travel destinations for Americans in the next hour? If you're a CATA bus driver, all you got to do is drive the bus. You could miss the green light and get the next green light to make sure you clear the intersection.
I'm pretty sure they're living on a schedule too, John, and that they'd be reprimanded if they don't make it.
Could you just agree with one thing I say today?
I'm sorry. It's kind of gloomy out. Can we agree on that?
Try it again. Steve, those really long buses, sometimes they block the intersection.
Well, they do sometimes block the intersection. I agree.
Street cafe. I'm on a street team. I love Meryl Streep and the flick One True Thing. I love traffic. I love the colors yellow and green. I like talk radio when they talk about things. Let's talk about things.
What's the first word of ensemble comedy? It's yes and or yes but.
Improv.
Yeah, you agree with the person even if you disagree.
Yes, but they probably have a schedule to meet, John.
They do, John.
So I didn't make up any ground there, but at least the gang did get around to that theory that I've heard but don't know that much about. It was from yesterday's show. I was complaining about gridlock. I said sometimes even the CTA buses will gridlock an intersection in the city, and they, more than anybody, should know not to do that. And they don't have anywhere to be in a hurry. It's a CTA bus. It'll come along eventually. And then Bertrand and Mary were saying, no, they've got pressures. They've got schedules they've got to meet. And I thought I had a point. They thought they had a point. And I thought that the best way for them to communicate that to me was to first agree with my point and then say yes and. And it reminded me that Kelly Leonard does a podcast called Getting to Yes And here on WGN Radio. We host it. He's that guy from Second City. You remember him as Roy Leonard's son. He's a really innovative thinker, and he's a great communicator in Chicago from Second City. Not only do they do improv, but they do teach those skills to businesses. I asked Kelly to jump on with us today, and he couldn't, but one of his colleagues can. Piero Procaccini is the director of improv at the Second City. And this is just kind of a weird little one-off, Piero, but I wanted you to join us and just tell me if I understand that theory right. And for just a few minutes, give me an instant tutorial on how we should use that in our daily lives. Can you do that for us?
Sure thing. Thanks, John. And it's a really great conversation. I mean, the short answer is, to an extent, you're both right and you're both wrong. So let me try to unpack that a little bit for you. Improv at its core, I think it's important to distinguish between onstage improv and offstage improv. Onstage, the principle of yes and agreeing to the reality established by your scene partner, that's really important. Because when you don't agree on that reality, that scene stagnates and it doesn't move forward.
Right.
But that principle applies offstage as well, as you're suggesting. You're absolutely right. The thing I would tweak is you don't necessarily have to spend time agreeing with the other person. We would encourage you to use the concept of yes and as spending a little bit of time hearing and entertaining and understanding the other person before you then respond. But off stage, it's really important to make room for people to disagree. Actually, because you know, if I'm like, give me all your money and why aren't you yes-handing me? Well, there's a really good reason that you're not, right? Like,
right.
It's important to create space for disagreement. But your point is so well taken, which is, I think they would get farther in that conversation if they spent some time hearing the meat of your argument, the sort of what matters to you about that argument before then responding, even if that response is a counter argument.
Understood.
So actually you all did a great job of fixing that afterwards. Like, it's really frustrating that the buses block the intersections, isn't it? Yeah, it is really frustrating. And then they can, of course, move on with their
point. As the recipient, so that's my message. Now, they want me to hear their message, but
yep.
If I get the feeling they didn't hear mine, then my door's closed to them coming with theirs.
That's exactly right. Yep, and that's actually the situation we find ourselves in a lot of times when we're arguing, which is that we're so taken by trying to convince the other person of our point of view, we're not hearing theirs, and that results in the same sort of stalemate that can happen on stage when we don't yes and.
Yeah, and clearly I was guilty of that myself, right? I was so hell-bent to make my point. Maybe I wasn't being sufficiently receptive to what they wanted to say, but I wanted to get a little affirmation back first.
That's right, yeah.
And
I mean, it's funny because the dynamic affects everybody involved, right? If you say no to me, I'm much more likely to reciprocate
right,
with a
but,
no.
But I have a question about
me.
That.
Yeah.
And I think, and this is husbands and wives, parents and children, colleagues, bosses and employees. This is everybody, right?
Yeah, absolutely right.
Okay,
yep.
But here's the problem. What if the person's initial statement, my suggestion that the buses block the intersection, say, mm-hmm. what if in fact it's patently false or you can't concede that point? Then what do you do? How do you get to yes and when you don't agree on the yes part?
That's a great question. So in that situation, the yes, so we oftentimes suggest instead of using the yes and externally, which if it fits, please do. But if it doesn't, use it internally. So use the yes to remind yourself, yes, tell me more. And then the and to remind yourself to contribute more. So if you disagree patently with the initial statement, spend a little bit of time better understanding what that person means by that statement.
Yeah.
A, it can help unlock sort of what their intent is. And B, when you respond, you're responding from a place of information.
So with the language of that conversation, maybe I don't have to say, yeah, you're right, John, but okay, I hear what you're saying, John, or well, that's your view on it. I hear you, but I mean,
yep.
I don't mean to parse this too finely, but you don't want to lie to the person either, right?
Right. That's exactly right. It's really important to be sincere. If you're using yes and the words and you don't mean them, they're probably having a worse effect than if you didn't use them at all.
Yeah.
And so, yes, exactly right. It's something to the effect of, wow, that hasn't been my experience. Help me understand that point of view better. Right. It shows that I'm respecting where you're coming from. I'm not trying to challenge you. I might end up disagreeing with you. But first, I want to make sure I've understood what your intent is.
This has been very helpful to me and hopefully to my colleagues. I hope they're listening to this.
Well, good. Hopefully helpful to everyone listening. Yeah.
I don't mean to defeat the purpose of what you've just said. I mean, it's not trivial or silly, but I think, yeah, we want, and that's probably the Achilles heel of this, right? I want the other person to do that. No, I need to do that first, too. I need to understand these lessons. Piero, I'm out of time, but you and Kelly and the gang over there, Piero Procaccini is on the phone line, the director of improv at the Second City, are really smart communicators, besides being funny people on stage with the improv. And this is what you guys do as a this is the business component of Second City, isn't it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. We teach these skills to companies, and exactly like you're talking about, there's a lot of subtlety to it. So we really try to make sure people understand how to use these skills in a way that actually helps.
A lot of subtlety to it. Dang. Okay. Hey, by the way, if people want to reach you, Piero, how do they do that?
Oh, you can reach me at P. Procaccini. Boy, it's a tough last name.
Boy, there's no chance that's going to happen.
P-R-O-C-A-C-C-I-N-I at secondcity.com. That's the easiest way.
Secondcity.com. I'll post a link on my page, too. Thanks, Piero.
That's great.
Yep.
Thank you so much, John. Bye-bye.
Yeah, have a good morning. 9:48. I'm a big college basketball fan, so every now and then I insert Butler basketball scores and news because a lot of people, very few people are interested in it, but I just can't help myself. And then I got DePaul tickets, and I watched the DePaul men play because Butler introduced me to the Big East, so then I became a Big East fan. I say all of this feet away from the voice of the Cats, Northwestern basketball, Dave Ennett, who's a Big Ten guy. Somebody said, hey, John, all of your comments on the awesome Big East and so forth, how about some comments on the awesome DePaul women's basketball team? Instead of all of the losing men's teams, DePaul ladies are ranked number 11. They're 19-2. They're 9-0 in the Big East. By the way, if you're clicked in on my headsets, by the way, it deserves a comment. Well, there you go. So everybody go see the DePaul ladies. They would be the winningest team, I guess, in the Chicago area.
They're
right
very
now.
Good. Northwestern's women are also ranked.
Are they really?
Yeah. Yeah. They're having a great year.
I don't know how frustrating that is for the women athletes or the parents or coaches, you know, people who have vested as much of their lives into the women's sports as the men have in theirs, and the women's sports just don't get the nod that the men's do. I can't change that, but yeah, let's at least mention it here. So props, go see the ladies play at Northwestern and DePaul. Do the women shoot a better three-point percentage than the men? Do the women shoot a better free throw percentage than the men? I've watched some
I think it varies.
Division I men's college basketball yeah. games, and mm-hmm. the free throw percentage was 50%. Grade school teams shoot 50%.
That's unusual.
It is.
Most are shooting far above that.
I'm just telling you, I've seen some games where teams have shot around 50%.
Mm-hmm. I've seen some individuals who have done
even that. You know, my wife and I get so mad at anybody over 6 foot tall with sneakers and a jock. You ought to be able to make, and then we argue about the percentage, right? Like 90%. So I went to the gym the other day, and I hadn't been there in a long time, and I hadn't literally shot a basketball in a year. Picked it up, I made 7 out of 10. Now, I know there wasn't a crowd with signs trying to distract me. I hadn't been out of breath, all of those things. But I thought, if I can make 7 out of 10... 7 out of 10 should be the threshold. Right. 75 out of 100 should be the threshold.
So here's the Big Ten men's. Wisconsin leads the conference at just about 76%. And Northwestern second at 75%. The worst team is Nebraska at 60%.
60%. That's an outrage.
That's the men. Now, you were asking about
so the range was 78%
to about 76.
76 to about
60%
for the men. Best yeah. to worst.
And then
the
you always game. Have some individuals who are great, you know, and never miss. Now the women, since you brought this up, Minnesota, and I'm just going Big Ten here.
Sure,
we could
sure.
pull this up with the Big East too. This is just an example. Minnesota leads the Big Ten at 75%.
Same as the men, essentially.
And Illinois is last at 63%.
So the
a little bit better.
The Lady Illini, the worst team in the Big Ten, are better
than
the
shooting
worst
free
team.
Throws.
Shooting free throws than the men. And the guys, they're a lot closer to the free throw line than the women are at the release point. Think about that. It's a shorter shot for them.
Slightly.
I'm just telling you that you get some 6 foot 12 inch dude and he just shoots that thing like a
6 feet 12. I think you're doing the ATM machine thing again if you say 6 feet 12 inch dude.
It's just a dart toss for him, and you go, you know, the rest of us, we're like 5'9". We gotta heave that ball. You're right there, dude.
Yeah.
Just drop it in the hole. Speaking of redundancies, John, I've always despised hot water heater. Hot water is already hot, so why are we heating it? Just let people have that one. ATM machines, PIN numbers, and hot water heaters, let them have them. It didn't cost you anything for their purchase of that extra word. John, here's another illogical expression, hot water heater. It's just hot water. Yeah, that one comes up a lot. John, I've always despised hot water heaters. I'm getting a bunch of these. About your dream vacation, the trips that you've taken or would like to take. It's National Vacation Planning Day. Later on, we'll visit with a travel agent about some of the hot destinations in the world right now. A cruise around Ireland, Scotland, and England. Also a cruise around the Hawaiian Islands. Last spring, my daughters and I visited the Isle of Skye in Scotland. It was surreal. It was breathtaking. I so want to go back. 630 says, in December, I spent 2 weeks in Uganda and Rwanda photographing the mountain gorillas. It was extremely physically challenging trip, but boy, was it awesome. I think for some people, that sounds like a bet they lost, which is the beauty of vacations, right? You want to go traipse through the jungles and take pictures of gorillas? No. Or yes. In December, I spent 2 weeks in Uganda. Ooh, I just read that one. John, I want to travel around the world in space, says Jack in Richmond. John, I want to walk in the steps of the Beatles on Abbey Road. People on my last trip, friends of ours did that. And it's not... What do you do? So you get out, you take a cab there, you get out, you do that walk. Here I'm walking, we're walking. You take your picture, then you get back in the cab. Mm-hmm. And that's a photograph a lot of people really want.
And a lot of people really have.
Yeah. Canoeing the Everglades is great, John. Hey, John, my dream vacation is to go to Monaco during the Grand Prix week, see all the lavish yachts and the fast cars. We were there a couple of years ago doing just that for the yachts and to see Monaco. It was one of the cruise stops. It's lovely. The yachts are just, they're so luxurious and so breathtaking. It's almost weird. It's like, who are you people? What's happening here? They were setting up for the Grand Prix. My grandparents are from Milan, Italy, and my dream is to find relatives still there and stay for a month. We went on a mission work trip to Kenya and a two-day safari. It cost under $4,000. It was the most fantastic experience watching the animals. And this one, hey, John, speaking of travel, we're trying to rent a car at O'Hare for our annual week-long trip to the Chicago area. What's the deal? Last year, our rental was $275. This year, it's over $500 for the same car. It's over $250 more in taxes and fees. What's going on? I do not know. If somebody is going to drive around in the Chicago area for a week and tour our great city, why don't you help them out right now? 312-981-7200. Give me your car. No, just what's the best option for somebody that needs a car for a week in the city? Driving around. Miles, gas, total rental. If you got any advice, I'll take it and pass it along. 312-981-7200. Seeing the massive icebergs float down from Labrador, John, and the gorillas in Rwanda.
I like the way you have guests on to criticize my communication skills while I'm not around.
Oh, Steve, no, hon. No,
what you mean,
honey,
to say? You mean
honey,
to say yes, Steve, but...
Honey, wait. Well, see, I don't want to affirm what you just said. We've been trying to learn how to do that here on this show, and we want to support each other. But if your starting point is a sad negative thing, I want to lift you up.
My starting point was being under attack, but that's okay.
Sensitive much? Perhaps you should not have a job in the media. So, well, you did hear the point. All right, so let's do this.
Yeah, yeah.
It's 10:07. This is WGN. Hi, I'm John Williams. And that real sensitive fellow over there is Steve Bertrand. He does the news. And Steve, I thought that you and Mary and I reached an interesting point of conversation yesterday where I had a story. You guys had another set of facts. And the purpose of that getting to yes and is that you want to affirm what the other person said. Agree with it to the degree you can, and then present your alternative facts.
Right. They're not alternative, not alternative facts, but you always get more play if you're talking with someone rather than at them, right? So you bring them in with you. I see what you're saying, John, but also keep in mind. They've got schedules they have to keep up with. And
we are going back to the substance of that conversation now. I was frustrated that sometimes we have gridlock in the city, and sometimes it's CTA buses, and I think they should know better than anybody. I was suggesting that they don't have to be anywhere. They're a bus. Just continue to drive down the road. They're not going to get off and make the meeting. They're just driving the dang bus, so don't gridlock the intersections. To which you all reminded me, they are on schedules, they have supervisors, etc.
Boy, this is really bothering you, isn't it, John?
Well, it's bothering me that you guys aren't affirming. Okay, so, hey, yes, guys, I see your point. I hadn't thought about the fact that
those
drivers have schedules and they don't want to be reprimanded for not doing a good job.
Okay, next topic.
Okay.
However,
we won, Steve.
Oh, I got to call those people back and get a ruling on this. I do not think at any point in positive business communication do you do an end zone dance after after you make your point.
Hey, you brought it up.
Mary's got her hands in the air.
I forgot about it yesterday.
Fist pumps.
You just brought it back up.
Hey, listen, by the way, we had that conversation before the news about somebody's coming to Chicago. They want to spend a week in the city. They said that last year when they did this, it cost them $250 to rent a car. Now it's $500. What's up? I said, let's give somebody a suggestion. If you are going to need a car in Chicago for a week, what's the best way to go? And some of you are saying what Alan is saying. Hey, Alan, you're on the air. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning.
What do you know?
You know, well, it's funny because I just went through exactly the same thing yesterday going to Los Angeles. And the problem is that the car rental companies charge a lot more money if you rent at the airport. So, and they all have offices like in residential neighborhoods too. So the what I did, and I've done this a couple times, and what they could do in Chicago, I think, is get on the L train at the airport, which is very cheap, get themselves into the city, like downtown, and then rent the car at one of the local places, you know, that's near downtown. And I did that, as I say, yesterday, and I saved like $150 on the rental.
For how many days?
It was for 8 days.
Yeah, that's, you know, I just ran into that the other day. Brenda and I have one car. Brenda had the car out of town. I needed a vehicle. I called the Avis on Broadway by the lake, nowhere near the airport.
Right.
It's a block from my house. I just walked over there for 24 hours, unlimited miles. It was $56. I said to the guy, well, then what's the mileage charge? He goes, no, there's unlimited miles, $56 for 24 hours. I said, you've got to be kidding me.
Miles.
Heck.
So that would work, especially with the L train being as cheap as it is. Now, in Los Angeles, I'm going to take you, they have a nonstop bus that goes I'm going to Hollywood. They've got a nonstop bus, so you get out of the airport, and it just takes you right to Hollywood. So I rented a car, you know, I think it was Enterprise in Hollywood. And then coming back, you got to do the same thing in reverse. You know, you return your car, and then get on the L train to go back to O'Hare.
If you don't want to do that, you pay for the convenience of being at the airport. I mean,
yeah, if you want to pay for it, fine. You know,
and you may. Well, by the way, you're going to Hollywood because you are an aspiring major Hollywood star.
Yeah, well, I'm actually a magician and I'm working at the Magic Castle. But so you're getting a little bit on the right track there.
How about that? All right, Alan. Well, this is helpful. Thanks for the call.
Good. Okay. Thank you.
I know what you're thinking. Boy, that's a lot of work. But if you want to save $150 over 8 days, John Turo for car rentals. It's like Airbnb. I don't know this company, T-U-R-O, but I guess, like I was kind of facetiously suggesting, that would be facetiously suggesting a moment ago, the same way you would rent out, I guess, your house to a traveler, you could let him use your car for...
Well, that was a huge thing for a while. I don't know what's come of it. The big car makers were forming like car clubs. So I don't know. Ford, I think, was one of them.
Really?
Like a car share. So, yeah, you come into town and you could borrow the car of another Ford owner.
How does that work with insurance, though? Must be a mess.
I don't know. And I don't know how far they've come with it. But I know they were up and running a few years ago.
Really? And I guess, like Airbnb, us Ford people... I know how to drive Ford. You got a Ford. Hey, we're Ford team. Go team Ford. But I would pay for that, right, Steve?
Yeah, you'd pay for it, I think. You'd pay something, but it'd be less than renting a car.
Yeah. John, it is much cheaper to rent a car in one of the close suburbs to O'Hare than on the O'Hare property. Elmhurst has an Enterprise on York Road. It's a $20 Uber ride away or $20 in a cab. Now, some of you are saying this. If you're coming to the city and you want to just enjoy Chicago, get a CTA bus pass for a week. No, that's not happening. I think people want more independence than that. Listen, I'm Mr. Public Transportation, but I don't think that's a sufficient answer for most people. John, tell them to rent off property. Yep, that's what we've done, says another listener. Parking in the city. This is an interesting thing, though. Say you're going to come to Chicago for a week. You want to enjoy our fine city. And you've got a good deal on a rental. You're going to park it. And if you park it in a hotel in the city, hokey smokes. The parking, I don't know what it is. It's like 60, 70 bucks a night to park your rental. So just keep that in mind, too, if you're at a hotel downtown. And maybe in some of the suburbs, too. To which this person says, parking in the city for a week will be equal to or more than the cost of the rental itself. If you plan to stay in the city, just use the public transportation or Uber. I think that's a good idea. I think if you came to Chicago, did not rent a car, you don't want to mess with the CTA, that's fine. Cab and Uber everywhere. And every time you want to go from here to there, register. You're just shelling out the money. You'll probably end up shelling out less money than you would if you rented a car and paid to park it in a hotel.
That's the smartest thing to do. And then you don't have to worry all the time about where am I going to put the car tonight?
Exactly.
Oh, I better move it to, you know, or even if you had Spot Hero, you could move it around, but that's a pain in the neck.
Yeah. Yeah. By the way, I was reading, what is the title of the book that I was reading? The New Chicago Way. The New Chicago Way. It's co-authored by Austin Berg. And he is one of the Mincing Rascals. And he was talking about what a bad deal the parking meters were for the city of Chicago. How they said, oh, we'll get a lot of money. It'll pay down some of our debt. But we blew through that cash so fast. And he was just talking about car rentals and things like that and some of the economics and how the city of Chicago gets it wrong. It's an interesting book I'll talk more about down the road. But so far, so good. John, thinking about renting, parking is $55 for 2 hours. I don't know where you're paying $55 for 2 hours, but it can sure be expensive. John, they used to have Car2Go in the city, charged 39 cents a mile, and they were Mercedes vehicles. It ended in Chicago because of the theft and because of politics. And one last note about this, besides that app Turo, T-U-R-O, somebody else sent me a screen grab of an app they have called Get Around. Rent and unlock cars. Sounds like some sort of car sharing program called Get Around, and that might be a good way to do it too. Huh. I hope that helps. It's 10:16. This is GN. Where are the hot places to go? The top five. We'll get to that in a little bit. And also a recap now that the Democrats have had their day, the Republicans are having their last day in the impeachment trial. So a summary, please. That'll come your way after 11 o'clock. Join WGN Radio and WGN TV at the biggest stair climb in Chicago. The Fight for Air Climb is presented by United Healthcare at Presidential Towers. At Sunday, March 8th, your first step is to register or donate at WGNRadio.com/events. Or fightforairclimb.org. You can climb 1, 2, 3, all four towers. That's 2,340 steps. Every step counts in our fight for clean air and healthy lungs. The American Lung Association's Fight for Air Climb, March 8th. It's fun physically to do. What a great challenge. Do as much as you can, and if you can do all of them, hooray. Either way, register or pledge your support at wgnradio.com/events or fightforairclimb.org. I mentioned Austin Berg, who's one of the Mincing Rascals. I wanted to play for you a part of the Mincing Rascals podcast. We normally do this on Saturdays. I wasn't on last Saturday, and I wanted you to hear a little bit of a conversation that we had with Eric Zorn, the columnist from the Tribune, Justin Kaufman, who is on in the evenings here at WGN Radio, Heather Sharon from the Daily Line, and our own Steve Bertrand. We were talking about an op-ed sent to the New York Times by a couple of the writers for the Chicago Tribune, who said that the Tribune is in peril. There's this Alden Capital Group, a bunch of hedge fund operators that at the end of June will take more control of the Tribune. And when they do that, they're going to fire more people. They will maybe decimate it. Those were their words, like they did the newspaper in Denver. So what's going to happen to the Tribune? I'm hoping that a billionaire comes in and rescues it, literally buys it and keeps the employees. That could happen. Eric Zorn was talking about what the mood is like at the Tribune these days.
We're worried around the newsroom. We're quite worried about this because on June 30th, a certain cap comes off of Alden's activity, and they are then going to be able to buy more than the third of the company they now have.
Why do people buy newspapers that don't want to run newspapers? I don't understand that.
Well, there's money to be made if you buy them up and you decimate them, as they say that they did to the Denver Post, which I think is a fair characterization of what happened there. And then you get in and get out. We had problems with Sam Zell, the real estate magnate, who bought us about, what was it, 10, 11 years ago, and we were all quite worried about that. Sam Zell, though, had pretensions of being the guy who could save American journalism. He thought he knew how to reinvent newspapers and make them profitable and great again. I don't have that sense from Alden Global Capital. I think they're money people, and they want to make money, and what they'll do is they'll come in and they'll slash the staff, and they'll cut it as far down as they can whilst they can still maintain their subscriber base. They'll try to weigh that out in a way, and then if it starts to go sideways, they'll sell off and they'll walk away with a lot of money, like Michael Farrow did.
Yeah.
The guy who
the last billionaire. The curious thing about the argument is there is no argument. That's the weirdest thing about this story, is that you'll hear, whether it's that opinion piece or other pieces that have been about this transaction, you're waiting for the other side to go, "We're not going to do that." There never is. It's almost like, in a way, they're like, "Yeah, that's what we do."
Yeah, you haven't heard anyone from Alden coming on saying,
"We're civic minded. We're going to build
David,
up." There's
calm
no,
down.
At least lie to us.
They're
come
not
on,
even
make me
lying.
Feel good
they're just
for
like,
a day.
"Yeah, that's what we do." So that's
so,
the scary
so the wolf
part.
Isn't even wearing grandma's clothes.
Yeah, they're just
now I'm a wolf. I'm going to eat you.
Yeah, there it's coming in. Just wait for July.
So what's it like in the newsroom when this goes out? Because I saw them interviewed. And they presented it, I think, to the editors the day before.
They said that they presented it to the editors the day before.
And the editors really said, "Please don't do this.
Don't do this." Yeah. I don't know what the damage.
Talk about the courage of their convictions. Yeah. I mean, I suppose somebody at Alden read this too.
Yeah, I mean, these guys are first class, both of them. And they're very decorated, investigative journalists, and they have a lot of clout.
So what is it like in the newsroom?
Well, one of the things that's going on right now is that buyouts are on the table. They're trying to pay people off to leave, basically, to try to get you to retire.
After only 8 years, which is a very low threshold.
After 8 years, yeah. 8 years is the minimum, I think. And then after that, I don't remember all the exact details of it, but essentially they're trying to get people to retire, and then they pay them a portion of their salary to go out the door, and those windows are going to be closing in the next week or two, and we'll know who's actually leaving. And then after that, I think my guess is that there's going to be some sort of a threshold they're going to have to meet for cutting the budget, and then I don't know where that goes and how they're going to do that. All of us around the newsroom are worried that this is a very risky, fraught time.
I would buy you guys and put my name on it. It'd be the John Williams Chicago Tribune. I wouldn't even do that. But, I mean, is it unthinkable?
Pizza toppings on the front page.
You have said before that the same way we support operas and symphonies and museums, we should support journalism. It's a shame it's come to that. To me, that's not even such a sad idea. I think that's... If I was the Ricketts or the Griffins or Oprah.
Rehouse, worked for a news organization that was owned by Joe Ricketts, mm-hmm. and it was not puppy dogs and unicorns and rainbows. You know, he shut us down because we tried to unionize.
That's Joe Ricketts, not Tom Ricketts.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. When he sort of fired us all, he said that he misunderstood how difficult it would be to make money at a news organization. He thought that would be the easy part. He thought the hard part would be to create an editorially sound project, because whenever we had meetings with him, he would talk about how committed he was to having, you know, fair and objective journalism. And he thought that was going to be much tougher than it actually was, because he hired a whole bunch of good journalists, not to, you know, pat myself on the back. But the fact that for, you know, 4 or 5 years, that's the sort of the operating assumptions that he was operating under, made all of us in that room, you know, people were crying, people, you know, were just really upset. It made me, you know, sort of suck in my breath and say, well, that's just appalling.
That you would doubt our commitment to
that
being neutral.
You had such a misunderstanding of the economics of the news industry. You thought that it was going to be easy to sell display ads to mom and pop businesses in Chicago neighborhoods, because that was the business model for a while.
This was DNA Info.
This was DNA Info. I read that op-ed, and I cringed a little. And I cringed a little for two reasons. One, after my experience, I cannot believe that another billionaire is the answer. I just cannot, because I lived through that, and it was a horrendous experience. And two, part of the op-ed seemed to say that, like, there were things that the Tribune could do that no other kind of news organization could do. But I wish that that op-ed had made the case for the Tribune without denigrating other kinds of media.
Especially when backs are against the wall.
I didn't read that. I just thought, as I say at the end of my show sometimes, or in the middle of my show sometimes, if you don't already, today would be a good day to subscribe to a newspaper. And then I thought I should amend that with, or patronize the sponsors of talk shows, because that's how we make our money. But the point is, let's all, with some sort of dollars, support the work that these people do.
We're a subscription model, and I cannot tell you the number of times that I tweet a link to a story and somebody's in my mentions saying, it's behind a paywall, how am I supposed to read it? And every day I stop myself from tweeting back, how about you drop us a cost of a cup of coffee and subscribe? The fundamental problem was that back in the mid-90s, we all decided that news was free. And so there's a whole generation of people out there who believe that news should be free, and are angry that we are now asking them to pay for the services which we provide. And it just drives me nuts. And that's the fundamental problem. And that can't be solved by another billionaire coming in and having the final say over what goes in the newspaper and what stays out of the newspaper.
Let me push back a little on that. I mean, I think we're looking for our Jeff Bezos, essentially.
So I know that Jeff Bezos has done really great things at the Washington Post. I hear from people all the time who are more on the conservative side of things, who have heard that message from the president, that it is owned by Bezos, and that Bezos has an axe to grind, and that that makes all of that coverage suspect. And I can't disagree with them. That's what we're taught to do as journalists.
Why can't you disagree with them? You can disagree.
I think they're wrong, but I understand where they're coming from.
Why? Because
if Bezos says, you know what, I don't want to be in this anymore, or if you're making my life harder at Amazon, he can pull the plug like that.
That makes you vulnerable, but it doesn't make you wrong. I mean,
no,
the journalism,
it does create an appearance of a conflict of interest, and it's one that the president has used repeatedly to ding the Washington Post.
I feel like, as present company excluded, and Mr. Zorn and all the fine people that work at the Tribune, that the argument that the city would suffer if the Chicago Tribune went under is short-sighted, in the way that I believe that there are great journalists in town telling the stories that need to be told. How they get to viewers, to listeners, to whatever, is still not figured out by the Tribune. A civic, that's what Heather's saying, a civic-minded billionaire coming in is not going to fix why Facebook and Google are making all the money that the Tribune should. They're not going to fix how the fact that we all are not paying attention, that people that are 10, 15 years younger than us don't read the newspaper. They don't read, that they don't go to your page.
Well, no, they don't go to our page, but they read our content. They don't subscribe to our...
They don't pay for it.
They're not home delivery subscribers. They're not. I mean, and you're right about that. I mean, the idea behind a billionaire is someone coming in, maybe who a benign owner who would buy it. And
that's what I was thinking.
Civic reference, and maybe someone who is not so politically. My fear is like Ken Griffin will buy it.
Well, I mean, wasn't that what the model used to be? That, I mean, Mrs. Pinchon, and I mean, you know, that the families, before the Tribune went public, that the families did own the newspapers in town, and they were sort of benign dictators.
I'll speak up in defense of the Tribune. It's a profitable organization. It's making money. It's just not making enough money to be owned by a hedge fund.
I want to go back to, would the community suffer? And I think it absolutely would suffer. And Eric, we had this conversation a couple years ago. I don't know if you remember, but it's already suffered. The benefit is we've got great voices. We've got, you know, Heather's side, and we had DNA Info. We had all of those things. And maybe this is me sounding old, but back in the day when you had dominant newspapers, we had a stronger sense of community. Right or wrong, the newspaper sort of set the news agenda.
I don't know, I don't buy that.
Okay, that's fine. You don't have to, but I'm telling you that there was sort of a... And this is back when there were four channels. We had fewer things to watch, so we had more things in common.
Yeah, that's not true. There were.
I'm going to punch you in the face.
There were communities.
Talk about your getting to yes and, Steve? That's
I knew you were going to end it there.
Well,
I knew it.
We're out of time, but the conversation did go on, and the question was, were the suburbs and the small towns getting enough attention?
And the minority communities.
Absolutely.
He changed my mind. He made excellent points there.
He really did. And we rarely turn the mincing rascals on ourselves and talk about our industries, our businesses, but the Tribune is more than just one business in town. I think it is a reflection of the community. So we spent some time on that, It all stemmed from an op-ed that a couple of writers for the Tribune put in the New York Times last week. I wanted you to hear a little of that conversation. The full conversation and other topics we talk about like that are The Mincing Rascals. Wherever you listen to finer podcasts, you can listen to that one for free. So I'm not a stock guy. I mean, an analyst, investor, or otherwise. I don't understand it. Yesterday, we lose 400 points because we're worried about the virus. The next day, we find out the virus is even worse. 100 dead, 4,500 that are infected, and the numbers are only growing, and now the market's back. What's changed?
There's a difference between the long-term investor and the person, you know, trading day by day.
I guess.
So they're buying now on the depressed stock prices from yesterday.
Right. So it went down. Now they're going, hey, the price
went
down. Let's jump in.
Right.
By the way, Tom wanted to say something as we move on now. It's 1034 WGN. I'm John Williams, and we were talking about the Chicago Tribune. I'll tell you what, if you are a billionaire, and they have radios, if you're listening and you have hundreds of millions of dollars, swoop in and buy the Tribune. And keep all of those swell people. Pick up the Sun-Times while you're at it. Tom, what did you want to say? You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for this great subject. When I talked to the young lady, picked up and I said it was kind of ironic. We just renewed our Tribune subscription, and we've been doing it forever. And you guys are talking about it. And I like to sit down and read a paper. The rub is that my children, grandchildren, if it doesn't have a screen, they don't look at it. But there is a little bit of a shining light there. We take the grandchildren to a bookstore, and they buy books, and they read them. I don't know how we transfer that reading into newspapers, but we'll keep trying. I do take articles out, and I show them to my daughters, and they look at me like I'm crazy, something about, you know, whatever. You know, this is a healthy food, and this is what you should do. But I don't know. I don't know. I'm on a landline. Does that tell you something?
Tom, I appreciate your listening, and I want you to continue to subscribe to newspapers, and I want you to patronize the sponsors of WGN Radio, okay?
I do that, especially when they run those specials on the beer pubs to go to.
All right, Tom, you keep doing that too.
Hey, thanks for everything. Drive safe.
I want to have a drink with him. One of the sounds of my youth was lying in bed and hearing the tearing of a story out of the Tribune in the morning, and it was my dad. And I knew that when I came down, he'd say, Johnny, look at this. And then it would be a story from something he's pulled out of the newspaper. And I wasn't going to get to my cornflakes until I went through this article about this thing. And sometimes he'd even underscore it. The problem isn't the paper, it's the pay. That's what Heather Sharon was talking about. The mistake that newspapers across the country have made is that they made their newspapers free online. So who cares if you subscribe to it digitally or the paper version? As long as you're paying for the information, the newspaper wins. They might save money if they didn't have to print it in paper. The problem is people have been getting it for free online. And now when you say, well, we want you to pay for the digital stuff, they say, skip it. I'll just go somewhere else. And if they do that enough, there's nowhere else. And then we all suffer.
Why buy the cow when you get the milk for free?
Yeah, exactly. Is that a saying, by the way?
Yeah, it has to do with a different subject, but
well, kind of works here, doesn't it?
Yeah.
All right. So yesterday we were talking about the theft of ATM machines, like literally just put a rope around one and yank it out. How did people do it in Chicago or the suburbs? They just grabbed it, wrestled it, and threw it in the back of a truck, right? And so then we just started to talk about how smart that is and how maybe obvious that is. I mean, you don't need to rob banks or people. There's thousands of dollars on every street corner in every city in America just sitting there waiting for the plucking. I'm not advocating this. I'm just commenting on the phenomenon and the availability. And then we started to get all sorts of crazy information about these things, some of which I wasn't sure is true. David Tenty is the executive director of the ATM Industry Association in the United States and Latin America. This guy knows more about ATMs than anybody. Hey, David, it's John Williams. You're on WGN in Chicago. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, John. How are you?
I'm real good. So just real quick, give me the headline on your business. What is it that you do, David?
Well, we're actually a trade association that represents all of the different stakeholders within the ATM industry globally. And I manage our regions here in the U.S., Canada, and Latin America. But we have all the biggest chunk of our membership are the ATM deployers, the credit unions, banks, independents, They represent about 40% or so of our members, and the rest would be the security people, network processors, and anybody else, the manufacturers of the ATMs themselves, anybody else that might touch an ATM.
Is this a common crime, people just stealing the whole damn machine?
More so than you might think. What usually happens is I'll start getting reports in some particular area. A couple of years ago, it was Plano, Texas. All of a sudden, had a rash of about 10 or 15 ATM thefts. And these organized crime crews that handle most of the ATM crime, whether it's be skimming or ATM theft, typically go from place to place when they kind of hone their skills and execute the same crime over and over.
I can just see these knuckleheads then. They got the ATM at home. It's in the garage. And they're like, now what? How do they, I can't open up some plastic wrapped things I buy at the store, let alone an ATM machine. How quickly do they actually get into the cash?
Well, it's not a bank vault, of course. There is a safe in there, but if you have the right tools and the right experience, it doesn't usually take more than a few minutes. The question is whether or not the police catch up with you before you have a chance to open the safe. Some ATMs now have GPS trackers inside of them.
Oh,
yeah, other
that's
types
a good
of equipment.
Idea.
So, yeah.
What about somebody said they have shredders in there, and once you tip it over, it just garbles, chews up the money. Is that a true statement?
Well, I've never heard of that before. I can't imagine how that would work inside of the cramped space of an ATM. Everybody who has a shredding machine probably has some sense of what that might look like, especially when it's a couple thousand $20 bills.
Okay, but, so that doesn't happen. How about an ink bomb? Do you explode the ink on them when they tip over or something?
Yes, their cash is loaded into a cassette. The cassette goes into the ATM, and you can add an ink staining device to the cassette so that if the cassette gets pulled out before it's disarmed or the ATM gets moved too much, for example, then that ink system goes off and it stains about a third or so of one side of all the notes in that cassette.
Who loses the money then? So if the money is stolen and it's not recovered, or it's stolen and it's stained, does the bank or the mom-and-pop shop that put the money in there, do they get their money back? Is that insured? What's the story on that?
Well, that whole bunch of different scenarios for that. The ATM, if it's a retail store, might be owned by the store itself. It could be owned by a service that provides the ATM. Financial institutions, of course, own their own ATMs generally. So if the notes are stained, they can replace them. They can if they recover them, they can take them back to the Fed, and they'll replace all that cash for them. So there's no loss. Most ATM cash is going to be insured. So for theft and other types of crime.
Oh, really? Because
so, the cash itself is could be owned, as I say, by the bank, by a service, by the ATM owner, but the consumer never loses on that if it's just a withdrawal.
So we've had three, I think, in the past week or so here, and I want to go back to what you said when you sometimes see, where you asked if this was on the increase, you see a flurry. Would it be your indication then that all three of these were maybe taken by the same band, or that others were influenced by the success of the first, or what's behind these flurries?
Well, you never really know until you get into investigating them. It could be copycats where some people think, oh, that's a great idea. The ATM in my favorite convenience store is not protected very well, so I'll try to snatch that. But more often than not, we see organized crime doing this. And, we had some instances recently where they connected 39 different incidents of theft. This was a skimming theft and a fraud type of crime, but that ranged from the East Coast all the way out to, I think, Utah was the furthest west that they ran.
Is skimming a bigger thing than stealing the actual boxes?
It is. That's still the number one crime in the ATM channel, and the number one thing we're concerned about. The Secret Service and FBI get involved in those things. Most of the banks have countermeasures to try to confound a skimmer that might be, placed in the ATM itself.
Yeah, but more skimming than stealing the money. I mean, it's that sophisticated.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And the next question, I think, on a lot of people's minds, David, is how much money is in those things? I know what you're thinking. John, you shouldn't be asking these questions. I don't think there's any harm in this. You and I knowing this isn't going to make you a robber. David Tenty's on a phone. He's an ATM industry expert. He's with the Association in the USA and Latin America. He's the executive director there. So he represents, this is a trade association group, and he's one of the executives. He's the executive director. So the point is, he knows a lot about ATMs, and with the rash of thefts, a few anyway, lately, we started to have some questions, and he's been kind enough to give us some answers. 312-981-7200 if you've got a question or comment as well. And I see that we do have some calls. David, how much money is in the average ATM machine?
Well, let me put that in perspective quickly. Ohio a year or so ago proposed a limit of $2,000 on ATMs because they thought that would probably deter some of the theft. The only issue is the average withdrawal from an ATM right now is about $150, so you can see that that's not going to last very long. The typical small ATM, retail ATM, a convenience store probably has somewhere in the neighborhood of $10,000 or $20,000 in it when it's been filled, replenished. Bank ATMs can hold as much as $200,000 and more in some of the drive-through machines at very high capacity.
What's the average fee?
It's about $2.60 right now, surcharge for independents. I think the bank average fee is a little higher than that, a little over $3.
Do banks make money or lose money on ATM machines?
Well, it depends upon whether you ask the bank. They tend to look at this as a cost center most of the time, as a customer service. For the independents, though, it's a business, and the surcharge and some of the interchange fees that are paid by the networks like MasterCard and Visa represent the income that allows them to have that ATM out there and then usable for the public.
I've moaned before that that's my money. Why are they charging me to get it? But that's a freestanding machine that somebody had to buy that needs to be serviced. And then this interesting point to me off the air. You said, say there's $100,000 in that machine. That's $100,000 of cash sitting there that the bank is getting no interest on. And they have a lot of those, so they literally have to have all of this cash dispensed, waiting for it to go out, but with no return on it. And if there is a fee, and if you're in network, there usually isn't, right? If there is a fee, it might not cover all of those costs. So for banks, they might actually lose money on their ATM network, correct?
That's correct, and that's why they're trying to use them in some cases for marketing and promoting other products and services to their customers while they're standing at the ATM waiting for their withdrawal.
Well, I could see why you'd want one in a retail establishment, right? Like a mom-and-pop shop, you're selling newspapers and snacks or whatever. I'll go there, sure, get cash. Now I've got cash in my hand. I guess I could have used my debit card to also just buy these items, but I suspect that there's some equation where you get the cash and then you tend to spend the cash on that spot, right?
Exactly. And the studies I've seen indicate there's somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 or 60% of that cash goes back to the store in the way of purchases.
Well, there you go. Yep. Vito had a question. Vito, you're on WGN. What's up, Vito?
Yeah, hypothetically, a friend of mine, if he were to try to take one of these ATM machines, what are the best tools to use? And do they have any tracking devices on them, or why don't they?
Well,
so you're looking for some instruction on how to steal a...
what type of tools would you recommend?
Any kind of a tool you can imagine. We see the crooks using grinders and saws. And,
that's what I thought.
Yeah,
small
almost
explosives.
Anything.
You could shoot the thing a few times, Vito. Clearly you've got a gun as well. I would just start shooting the thing.
No, just tools. So I was just wondering. And I'm guessing it's best to take it after the armored truck refills it. You don't want to wait to the end of the day. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, if an armored truck refills it, sure, you could keep that up. But, some of the ATMs are refilled by the merchants with cash in the store, for example, and other sources. So, exactly, and that may be especially what some of the organized crime crews are doing.
Well, why don't they have trackers on the machines?
Yeah, that's you alluded to that, David. Is that very common?
It's not particularly common. It's available, but all of that adds cost.
John, I got to go. I'm almost done with the machine.
Okay, goodbye. I'm hanging up on you, Mr. Comedian. But right, so that's just another cost for the merchant, right?
Sure. Yep. As is the ink staining device and the other countermeasures that, you know,
Plus, while it may happen often enough, it maybe doesn't happen that often, but I just know some small businesses owners, you know, and I see the ATM machine in their shop, and that's cash they've taken essentially out of their own personal bank account. At least this is one scenario, right, where the local retailer, that's his or her money. And again, they're not earning any interest in that. They feel a little vulnerable putting the cash in there. But the idea is that it will make more people more likely to stop into their store. It's just a magnet, right?
Sure. Yep. Well, there are things they can do to help minimize the risk of theft. We recommend bollards in front of the store if they have large plate glass windows, for example. There are kits you can use that provide a lot more secure fastening of the ATM down to a floor. You're, you know, embedding those in the concrete or a wall, for example, right next to it. You know, things like that are often a big help.
Yeah, a couple of our listeners said, why don't they just make them super heavy so people can't haul them off? Is that an option? Do they do that?
Well, we had one case where somebody stole a front loader and tried to pick up a drive-thru from a bank. Not successfully, but they'll find a way around it if you make it heavier too.
Yeah. Well, I guess that kind of answers Pat's question. Hey, Pat, you're on the air. What was your bright idea?
Why aren't they bolted down to the floor? You see all these things and they're freestanding. Why aren't they on a steel base bolted down to the floor like safes are?
Yeah, what about that, David? Is that do they do that sometimes?
Well, they should be, and that's we have best practices for all of that for ATM installations available to our members, and that is the recommendation. And I had mentioned just a bit ago that there are some kits available that you can buy to add on that provide, you know, I forget what it is now, inch or 2 inch diameter bolts that help fasten that ATM to the floor. And or to the wall if it's right next to a wall. The other thing that helps is don't put it right in front of the plate glass window that's in the storefront. You know, that just makes it a whole lot easier to get it out of there if somebody decides to throw a chain around it.
Smash and grab, right? They just literally drive their car through and grab the thing and off they go. Our ATM machine, David Tenty's on a phone line for just a couple more minutes. David Tenty is the executive director of the ATM Industry Association in the United States. Latin America is his region. Are ATMs more common here in the U.S. than in other countries? Were we late to the game or early in the game?
No, we were pretty early to the game. It was supposedly invented in Europe in London. The first one went out in 1965, or 67, rather. We celebrated the 50th anniversary of the ATM here fairly recently. And it was in the U.S. just a couple of years later. So our ATM per capita is pretty high, and I think we're still highest in the world.
It's hard to imagine a world without some things like, you know, phones that are computers in your pocket and ATM machines. Once upon a time, you made sure you got cash because the banks are closed on Sunday, and that just sounds so alien to a young person, but that's the way a lot of folks grew up.
Sure.
Easy access to cash was not so easy, and now the things are just everywhere. A few thefts in Chicago made us think a little bit about this. Okay, this has all been helpful information, kind of fun. David, if I got more questions down the road, I'll sure give you a call. I appreciate your help.
All right, appreciate it.
Oh, by the way, John, ask him if money deposited goes toward money withdrawn later. I'm not sure what that means, money deposited.
There are recycling ATMs which can actually take the cash that's deposited and then, you know, sort that and put it back out as a withdrawal, cash for withdrawal. Those are becoming more popular. We don't see a lot of them in the U.S. They're more popular in Asia and Europe where folks do a lot more deposits, cash, frequent deposits. But we're seeing more and more of that just to help keep the cost of replenishing those machines down.
I get the point. What is the success rate? What percentage of the time do they get it right? Because I'm amazed that thing spits out the exact correct amount of cash every time. The a dollar bill is very thin. How often do they make mistakes?
It's very, very, very rarely. I mean, there are about a billion withdrawals every year in the U.S., and so it's very, very rare to have that happen. But it does happen, especially if the notes start to get, crinkled or dirty or what have you.
One time I was supposed to get 520s. I got 420s and 100. And so I
lucky you.
I went in and told the bank, and they just about jumped for joy. They were so happy that I was, you know, making them $80 whole again. I don't know who would have to eat that, but I guess the bank. Listen, it's nice to talk to you, David. We'll visit again. Thanks for your help today.
You bet.
David Tenty with the Association. Next, our media group, Washington correspondent Kelly Myers on the line. We'll go to her in just a second, but I just wanted to throw out more than a sports trivia question, which should be of interest to people in Chicago here. Hey, Dave Ennett, which baseball manager has been fired 4 times and hired 5 times? Want to take a guess?
Well, I think there are probably quite a few.
Actually, that doesn't narrow the
fit that the description.
Field.
But I think I know the guy you're talking about.
Well, here. I'm just looking at the USA Today today. Thank you, Harry Tynowitz, for pointing this out to me. They're saying they are hearing that Dusty Baker's going to get the Houston Astros job.
Bob Nightingale of USA Today is reporting that he is going to be the guy.
And he is
walking into a mess.
And saying that he's the right guy for the right place at the right time.
It probably is.
Yeah.
Probably is.
Do you agree with this sentence? Nightingale writes, there's no manager in the game more well-liked, respected, and admired by his peers and players throughout the industry than Dusty Baker.
Yeah, you know what? I think he was always liked and respected around the game and maybe more other places than in Chicago when he was here with the Cubs. I mean, I think he was loved here for a while. You know, and but for, you know, again, I mean, people get enamored with a guy, and after 2003, even though they were still a winning team the following year, you know, I think the bloom was kind of off the rose.
Nightingale says the Astros caught using illegal electronic equipment to steal signs, resulting in the suspensions of from general manager, etc., are going to be facing horrendous backlash every time they leave the city limits of Houston. They will be insulted, scorned, and ridiculed, and that's just by the other players. Fans will taunt them, too.
As you say, Dusty's going to have to do an exorcism in every dugout, right?
Is that something that he did before, Steve?
Didn't he, David?
That wasn't him.
It wasn't him?
No, but there was the front office.
I thought it was him.
Wait a minute. The Cubs did exorcisms?
Well, it wasn't an exorcism.
Shtick about the goat and all of that and the curses?
No, that wasn't the goat. They did bring a goat out to Wrigley Field. That was way before Dusty got here.
Fans will taunt them every time they step to the plate with chance of cheater.
It's going to be brutal. It's going to be absolutely brutal for them.
And Dusty's the guy for the job. Boy, I guess you want that job if you can get it. But
I mean, he has won every place he's been. He's got, you know, he won here. He won in San Francisco, took them to the World Series. He took the Cincinnati Reds to a couple of division titles. He took the Washington Nationals to the playoffs. I mean, the guy has been a winning manager throughout his career.
It's not official yet, but Nightingale at USA Today says Astros make the right call. Dusty Baker is the new manager. Well, I know you'll keep your eye on that. Thanks for just a little thought. But a good deal, says Dave Ennett, for Dusty and maybe the Astros, too.
Well, they got to do something. They have to have a manager.
They do need somebody. Yeah, yeah. 11:13 on WGN. Let's visit with Kelly Meyer now. Washington correspondent, Nextar Media Group. I don't know, do you follow baseball in Washington, D.C. as well, Kelly? Are you a Nationals fan?
A little bit. I'm actually originally from the Philly area, so I'm a fan at heart, but I was cheering for the Nats when they won the World Series. That was a pretty exciting time to be here.
I should say. So today's the last day for the president's team to make their case to the Senate. The managers are all... I guess the House managers for the Democrats made theirs last week, and the president's team, starting on Saturday, made their presentation. Can you just give me an overall summary? What have we seen and heard in the last few days from the president's team?
Yeah, they really went out and tried to make this concise argument. They said they didn't want to take up as much time as the House managers have. They wanted to get to the point. They're really saying and putting the pressure on the Bidens and his son, both Joe Biden and his son Hunter Biden, and really trying to show that what being accused of them from the Democrats isn't really an impeachable offense. So they're just trying to show that there is these articles of impeachment don't have really any weight, and as well as at the same time trying to show why the president may have wanted to investigate potential corruption from the Biden family. So that's what they were focusing on over the course of their opening argument. Like you said, they're going to be wrapping up today. We're hearing that it could be an early day on the Hill. They might be wrapping up pretty quickly. And then, of course, we go on into the questioning. But within that time frame, of course, we heard the reports of John Bolton's new book, the manuscript coming out that he was directed or told, shared a conversation with President Trump that they were saying that they were going to withhold that military aid to Ukraine over this investigation into the Bidens, further backing Democrats' argument. Now this brought up a new push from some senators to bring in new witnesses. That's really where the conversation is at on Capitol Hill. Will this trial go on further? Will they bring in any witnesses? And we're kind of hearing from some Senate Republicans that they would be willing to hear from that side. But also, if you're going to bring someone in on the Democratic side for a witness, then you have to do the same for the White House defense as well. So maybe this whole tit-for-tat Bolton for a Biden kind of thing is being thrown around up here as well.
Now, I saw this morning that it might be a one-for-one. We'll get one, you get one. If it was Bolton, right. Which, talk amongst yourselves about that, but I just don't understand that. But okay, so one-for-one, would it be Hunter Biden or would it be Joe Biden, the Biden that would be the other one?
Yeah, I mean, and that's the big question, too. Would Joe have to come in here from the campaign trail? I mean, we're just days away from the Iowa caucuses, or would they want Hunter to come in? It doesn't seem like Democrats, at least, and Schumer just came out here this morning at Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, saying that he doesn't see the need to bring in Hunter Biden, basically. But that is something that Republicans, some Senate Republicans, have voiced. But they do, at least we have heard from some Senate Republicans that they would like to hear from Bolton. They think it would be fair to hear from him, as well as another witness from the White House side. But again, that vote may come up Friday or so, but we really don't know if they even have the votes to bring in another witness, and we really won't know until Friday when you see how senators will decide, because you might even see some Democrats deciding with Republicans and some Republicans maybe so-called going with Democrats, so you just don't know how it's going to weigh out when you need those votes.
But I'm hearing you say that these senators on the Republican side who would be willing to get Bolton up there are going to do so not flat out, but rather as a trade. I mean, that's where this thing is leaning. It's not Bolton and nobody else. If it's Bolton, then it's somebody else. It's probably a Biden, correct?
Yeah, I think, they whether they want to hear from John Bolton coming up with this, it seems like, at least from senators like Utah Senator Mitt Romney, Maine Senator Susan Collins, they're saying that they're open to hearing from them. They haven't really said the... You know, they kind of made mention that they would like to hear from maybe one from each side if that comes to it. But they did say right off the bat, as this news was coming out yesterday morning from the Bolton manuscript, that they would like, it was becoming increasingly clear that they would maybe have to call him in for a witness testimony due to what was being released in this alleged report, basically.
Yeah, and I don't suppose you've seen the passage from the book, have you? The New York Times has, evidently, but we're all just hearing about that. Which, okay, that's secondhand.
Exactly.
So that's secondhand reporting about his firsthand account, but it's just odd to us that there exists the possibility that while the man is right there, rather than have him testify, they would turn in the portion of the book about this conversation.
Right.
I'm asking you how much traction that idea has in the Senate.
Yeah, and I think that's the question that's kind of coming out more and more today. We're hearing from, I believe, Senator Lindsey Graham was saying that he wanted to get his hands on what was said. And I think some of the Republicans from the White House defense team that are on the congressional side were saying just that, that this is secondhand information, that they're not sure. That it was Mark Meadows from North Carolina that said this, that he was seeing this coming out, secondhand information coming from an outlet like the New York Times. It just didn't seem like they were trusting the validity of it. So I think a lot of senators are now calling for the manuscript to see what it says themselves, read it themselves, and then decide if they want to call in that witness.
Do you have any sense from some senators besides the ones we've heard from, like Collins, Markowski, Romney?
Mm-hmm.
Are there any more mainstream or even hardline Republicans that are softening up on the issue of witnesses?
There's some that are coming up for that won't be going for re-election. That they're just, you know, Lamar Alexander from Tennessee is going to be retiring at the end of the year. Richard Burr from North Carolina is retiring. So some people have mentioned Alexander and Murkowski, like we said, Gardner. But we're really looking at these states that are either purple or swing, or they are up for re-election, things like that. And you're even seeing in places like there's more moderate Democrats, like Joe Manchin from West Virginia. Will he decide? He hasn't really said how he'll go either way, or given a firm real answer if any of these rise to the level of impeachment. So it'll be interesting to see also if he decides to go some way or the other. So they're really looking at these states where they're very divided, or did they have a Democratic senator and the state went for Trump in 2016. We're kind of paying attention to those areas. But otherwise, it seems like very much one side for Republicans, one side for Democrats overall on the issue.
Yeah. One last thing. The USA Today has a story today, and they just sort of recounted their observations about the behavior of the senators. And so they're sort of, they're not mocking them, but they're just reporting how sometimes they're using their, they're fidgeting, they're getting a glass of milk, literally. But I also took away from the article that the senators are there and they are largely paying attention. We've heard about Lindsey Graham going for a walk and some of them appearing on TV during the testimony itself. But it makes it sound like they are being fairly attentive. What's your assessment of that?
Yeah, and I will say that we are allowed to go into the room as members of the press, and they do have an extra layer of, I guess, another credential, so to speak, to get into that area. So I have one of those, and I've been inside the room and kind of took it all in, because you can't take your phone in. You can only take notes, pen and paper, and watch them from the gallery above. But like you said, you are seeing the majority of senators really engaged, and a lot of them taking notes, some of them not taking notes. I'll make sure I make a clear assessment of who is and who isn't when I go in later today. But I think also it's interesting to see they're all in there at one time, which is very rare, to see them all in their seats paying attention like they are in school to the arguments. And like you said, they are drinking milk. They can't have anything else, and they have to take a proper break for dinner. But overall, largely, they are engaged in this, maybe sometimes talking to each other and smiling, or, kind of sharing thoughts and things like that. I know people have talked about the candy desk that Pennsylvania Senator Pat Toomey is in charge of, and a lot of the candy that's been coming in for that just by the pile loads. So there are some, little quirky things about how they try to stay awake. But I know definitely I was talking with senators the morning after the first long day. Remember last week opening on Tuesday, and then them coming back Wednesday morning. I think they were here until like 1 or 2 a.m. that night, and they could barely keep their eyes open. So it was, interviewing them, they kind of had to take a pause, regroup, and then go into the interview to make sure they were, sound and could make a coherent statement, basically, to us on camera.
Imagine, I remember when you were in school, high school, college, whatever, and the teacher would be up there lecturing, and it'd be a sunny day, and you'd start to get the nods, and you couldn't fight it. Now imagine you're doing that all day long, and you're 70, and you're a United States senator, and you don't even believe what you're hearing, or you especially do, but either way, you've heard this now for the fourth time. I would imagine it would be hard for them to stay awake, literally, for that sometimes. By the way, the New York Times, according to 708, says, John, the New York Times has not seen the book. Only a copy is being read at the White House for security clearance. That is my understanding, too. Copy is sent to the White House, then they're able to vet it to make sure there's no security violations. But the New York Times has somehow gained access to that information, and that's what they're reporting on, this Bolton bombshell, they call it. The president's attorneys today have said that even if that were true, it's not a crime. It's not an impeachable offense. So they're going down that road. By the way, Kelly keeps cutting out. We'll just let her go. Thanks, Kelly, for joining us today. But that's the latest on where we are today in Washington. By the way, this story in the USA Today about the behavior of the senators, they write, the official camera in the Senate has stayed locked on those speaking, leaving everything else happening in the chamber and outside of it unseen by us TV viewers. Throughout the trial, senators have dozed off. They've passed notes. They've munched on snacks and sometimes laughter shaken their heads in disapproval. They've passed notes back and forth from one another. Many of the 100 senators, Tom Cotton, Richard Burr of North Carolina, Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania, have been spotted with those spinners in their hands.
The fidget sticks?
Yes. And those were handed out by the Republicans, remember, originally.
I thought that was a joke.
When Schiff went up there, because they, all right, here we go. But now they're using them even when their own side is speaking. I wouldn't read any more into that. I think originally it was passed out because it was a commentary on the Democratic side, but it seems to be working for both sides.
It would be a completely different show if we could be watching them.
But oh, my gosh.
But I don't know if we'd be better served or not.
Why do you suggest that?
Well, it'd be a better program. It'd be more entertaining.
What would be the harm in it?
We would hear less of the evidence, maybe. I don't know.
Most senators took notes or read through documents handed out by the pages. Rand Paul busied himself with a crossword puzzle at times. Last week, Senator Jim Risch of Idaho was the first spotted by the USA Today to fall asleep. He was followed promptly by Bernie Sanders and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Many senators are spotted yawning or roaming around the Senate floor to stretch, maybe just to stay awake. Let's do this after the break. Elif, how old, what is the average age of a United States senator? John, so a fired staffer writes a book about his opinion, and it just so happens to be leaked on the day the defense is wrapping up in the trial. Are we all that stupid to believe this? If this was your trial and a former fired staffer wrote a book, do you honestly think a judge would allow this in the trial after discovery has passed? It's political kabuki theater.
Well, that's why you make him swear an oath to tell the truth and testify. Because if he's making it up, then he's guilty of perjury and you go after him. He just made the case for having Bolton testify.
224 said, if they can't stay awake, they got no business occupying that seat. I said, well, it's hard for people that are 70 years old to stay awake all day long.
That wouldn't be a good Bernie campaign poster.
Well, that's all the more reason. They probably don't want the cameras turned on themselves. I'm sorry. Too bad. Then don't run for office. Producer Elif, what is the average age of a United States senator, please?
62.
Hokey smoke, 62. 62. I thought it was older than that. I thought it was 72. It was once upon a time. Now we got some young pups in there. Amy Klobuchar. Who else is a real young senator? Cory Booker's not that old.
Tammy Duckworth is young.
Yeah, now that you mention it. Dick Durbin's north of 62. Obviously, Mitch McConnell is. Lindsey Graham's over 62. I guess it goes back and forth, huh? Who's the... Producer Elif. Who is the youngest? What is the age of and who is the youngest United States senator? Well, they'll stick around for that, John. Today is National Plan Your Vacation Day or something like that. It is the day set aside. And it sort of makes sense in January to say, okay, let's plan a vacation. And if so, then when and where would that be, right? And so it just made, in fact, last night, I discovered that this morning. Last night, friends of mine posted a picture of them sitting at the kitchen table with a great big map of Ireland, and they're going there, I think, for a family wedding, and they were really enjoying planning their vacation. We're going to go here, we're going to go there, and they had brochures, and it looked like so much fun. It reminded me that the fun of travel is not just the travel, but it's also the planning for it. I have a trip with Kelly Cruz is coming up in October. I've been enjoying that trip for several months now, just because we've been thinking about it. Every now and then I see something in the news. More people are signing up. Steve, you travel a lot, and a lot of our listeners travel with you, and I'm sure you would second that emotion, right?
Yeah, I love going over. When I've got a group going, and it's taking a group to Scotland, sending the people like the links for the hotel site so they can see. You were talking earlier about Montreux.
Yeah.
And the Jazz Fest. We were there over the summer and actually stayed. Who was it? Deep Purple wrote the song.
Somebody pointed that out.
We all went back to Montreux.
Elif. Yes.
And it was we stayed at the hotel where they wrote the song. It was a Frank Zappa concert, I think. It burned down the concert hall.
Really?
It was really cool to go around and see all that stuff, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So answer the question for me that we were asking earlier. Favorite destination? Like, everybody was telling me, Steve Grzanich's was to see the Aurora Borealis overhead in Finland. That's his goal. That's his bucket.
Okay.
What's the thing you've done or most want to do on a vacation?
Well, the most beautiful place I've been to, I think, is Norway, in the fjords of Norway, which I didn't expect.
I just wish we could get those in a better place for me.
What do you mean?
I like cities with more history, with more restaurants and shops and cobbled streets.
Well,
and
you've heard of Oslo, right? The Peace Accords and the Nobel Peace Prize and Balestrand on the other side.
How far are the fjords from Oslo?
We took a train.
Okay, maybe the fjords. I mean, I'm not poo-pooing it. Yes, I am. That was the very definition of poo-pooing it. But okay, that's your thing, and Steve likes that idea too.
The coolest night we ever had was we were in Figlini, Italy, outside of Florence, and there was a little village where we were staying, and they happened to be having their autumn harvest festival. So we were in a real thing with these like giant loaves of mortadella and you know, truffled cheese and homemade wines and things like that. I'll never forget that night.
I would say one of the best things I felt I was doing, not as a tourist, but I was a traveler, and it accommodates tourists, but it's going to happen with or without me getting off the bus, was the antique market in Paris. The largest antique market, junk show we call them, the largest antique market in the world is the one in Paris. And it's the first or second weekend of the month, whatever, and we were there, and we were strolling through it, and we didn't buy that much stuff. We bought some items, and then we broke for lunch, and it was just like, this is so fun.
That was one of my trips, because some people loved it, and some people just did not like that.
Agreed. You know? Agreed. Some people go, "Wait, we could be Kane County for crying out loud! What are we doing here?"
Right.
I'm like, "Oh, shut up!" You know, I went to your cathedral. You're going to my flea market, so let me have my flea market. And we had a great time there. But yeah, don't do that if you don't want. Here's the other challenge for you: 312-981-7200. A lot of you are suggesting things like this, but Bertrand and I have traveled a little bit overseas, and some of you said, what about the United States? So is it Mount Rushmore, or is it someplace in Tennessee? Tell me that place that you've been that you've enjoyed the most, or that you'd like to go the most, but in the continental 48 states. Let's do that, too. And by the way, SteveBertrandTravel.com.
Right.
To travel with Dave Ennett to Ireland?
No, Scotland in June. Yeah, we've still got some spots. You can look at the website, SteveBertrandTravel.com, or call me, 847-606-6065.
By the way, our friend Sue Kelly does travel and talks about that on WGN Radio sometimes, too. Hi, Sue. How are you?
Good morning, John. How are you? Happy National Plan Your Vacation Day.
I think I know the answer to the question for you. The best thing you've done on a trip, or the one thing you still want to do the most, but answer that for me first. What's the best thing you've done on a trip yourself?
I think it was the safari in Africa, and it might not be for everyone, and it sounds kind of gross, but we were there right after two cheetahs, the brothers, had a kill, and we watched them do their thing, and then we watched how nature progresses, and the buzzards were in the tree, and the jackals were here, and the wild dogs were back there, and everybody kind of waited their turn. It was fascinating.
Hmm. Was this the time that you went up in the balloon and watched stuff?
Yes. So that was part of that trip where we did sunrise over the Masai Mara in the balloons, up, up, and away at sunrise. It was an incredible trip, and I would do it, the whole thing, I would do the whole thing again tomorrow.
Huh. Because as much as I like to travel, I like a little luxury around me, and that sounds kind of scaled back.
You know, it's really not. Today, you know, we talk about, we see glamping in, you know, the Pacific Northwest, but I really think that began in these incredible tented camps throughout Africa. I mean, there's basics, sure, but our tent that we stayed in had a couple of walls. It had, you know, running hot water and a beautiful bathroom. So it's not like your Boy Scout and your Girl Scout camp.
Yeah. One last question about that. If I do that, the tented camps in Africa, that sort of thing, how's the food and beverage?
Excellent. They have great beer throughout Africa. We had wonderful beer. We had wonderful South African wines. And the food was excellent. I mean, it really and truly was, because that's part of this. They're cooking for you every night, and you choose off of a menu. It's incredible. And the largest prawns I've ever seen, bar none. Bar
okay.
none.
All right, let's do this. I'm going to pause.
Okay.
Come back and answer the question for me. Five hot destination spots. And help me out on this too, Sue. I know that you are with Kelly Cruises and Travels, so you guys are more overseas, but let's just highlight some places in the U.S. of A that folks might want to travel to as well. I'm getting some texts about that as well. 312-981-7200. Right now we're talking about the travel planning that a lot of folks are doing this time of year. It's Travel Planning Day, which is just a made-up holiday. But it does get you thinking about some of these trips. John, parasailing off the Alps, Murin, Switzerland. I hope you do that.
When we were in Switzerland, they were doing that. It's just amazing. They're coming over your head.
Oh, man.
Just, I mean, dozens. It's like a constant stream of these parasailers.
Really?
Beautiful.
Mount Vernon, rich in history. And we did Monticello, and we're happy for every minute of it. This is funny, though. 630. A perfect vacation is where I can experience nature without looking at the phone for work emails. Disney World is one of the most stressful experiences of my life. With so much planning, even without the kids. I know people who go to Disney dozens and dozens of times. They've been there hundreds of times. They just can't have more fun than they have at Disney World. And for other people, it just looks like lines and a to-do list with your phone in your pocket. Sue Kelly jumped into the conversation with us here. With Kelly, what is it? Kelly Cruises and Travels, or Travels and Cruises? What's the name of your shop?
Kelly Cruises and Tours.
Kelly Cruises and Tours. I should know, having traveled with you for, gosh, how many years now, Sue?
It has been 14 years, almost 15. Yeah. Almost 15 years.
So that's about 13 trips Brenda and I have done with you all?
Yes. Exactly.
And our next trip is going to be in October, when we go from Istanbul to Venice for, I think, 8 nights on a cruise, right?
We're nine nights on the brand new Regent Seven Seas Splendor.
Yeah.
October 14th. I'm actually going down next month, John, to see the christening ceremonies and sail on the Splendor, so I can get a little sneak peek for us.
Well, this boat has literally not been in the water yet. This will be brand spanking new.
Right. New car smell for sure. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So go 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 real fast. Your favorite, the hot spots. What are the hot destinations? Top five.
Okay. Well, I'm going to start with, you had mentioned domestic, and I had one on my list, especially for all those parents out there that haven't thought about spring break yet. Destin, Florida, it's always been there. It's always been a great destination, but they have really upped their game. There's always been affordable options and things, but they have far more upscale options and condos and homes. You get the beautiful Gulf, the beautiful Gulf beaches that we all know and love, but maybe without the price tag or the drive of Naples and Fort Myers, etc. It's a 14-hour drive from Chicago. So for those, that are piling the kids in the minivan, this is a doable spring break. So I just thought I would start with that one for something.
And that's Destin, Florida?
Destin, Florida. So it's kind of between the Gulf Shores and Panama City.
D-E-S-T-I-N, isn't Destiny. Yes. Destin,
mm-hmm.
Florida.
Destin, Florida.
Got it.
Okay, now I'm going to come back, but I'm not going to stay in the lower 48. I'm going to go up to Alaska. And we all know Alaska is a beautiful, incredible destination. I think you've had a lot of commercials running recently.
Yeah, we have.
And here's kind of the thing. So sometimes we capitalize on a destination for different reasons. And with Alaska, this is the year to go. Because there's a lot of ships in Alaska right now, which means for the consumer that the cruise lines have all, in order to be competitive, we are seeing more perks and inclusions and shipboard credits and shore excursions. Our friends at Regent are even throwing in first class air. So it's a year to capitalize on the value of this incredible destination. It really is the last frontier, and it should be on everyone's bucket list, I think. So that's my second one. My third one would be Egypt. And again, this is another destination that's a huge bucket list item. And here with Egypt, it's a timing issue. Some destinations just, that's the way it goes. Right now, Egypt is a green light, and people are going, and they are booking early. You have to book early. It's sold out. It's incredible how Egypt is selling out, but who wouldn't want to see 5,000 years of history and, you know, the pyramids? So that destination is red hot. You know, there's just, for those that have any interest in UNESCO World Heritage Sites, you know, really kind of, it covers so many different things. So Egypt, I would really say, is at the top of the list as well.
Hmm.
My fourth one, I would pick river cruises. Now, river cruises have been around a long time, and we all know about the Danube, and I think we've done that one, haven't we, John?
I loved it.
It is. It's amazing. But there are, we all thank our friends over at Viking. They have opened everyone's eyes to what river cruising is. But there are more new destinations. There are more itineraries. So it's not just the Danube or the Rhine anymore. There's South Africa to, you know, Chobe National Park in Botswana. You can do river cruising in Cambodia and Vietnam down the Mekong. And really the biggest, hottest one right now is Portugal, the Douro River in Portugal. It's amazing. Sailings are booked, you know, through the summer. We're really in fall dates at this point for the Douro. And frankly, Portugal as a destination is really, really popular. It's a great value. And there's so much to see and do there. So
I was surprised the times we've been on the riverboats, how luxurious they are. The rooms aren't as big as on a cruise ship, but they're big enough. And the dining and the beverage.
It's amazing.
And just the accommodations. It's just it's amazing what they can do on a riverboat, but it's no compromise. It's fantastic.
And we saw those boats on the Douro in Portugal in just, I think it was October, just beautiful.
Really?
Portugal is just fantastic.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Those cruise lines that people have probably never heard of, like AMA or UniWorld, Crystal and Scenic, they are upping their game. And the river cruising, you know, from 15 years ago, as you know, John, it's just, that's not what it is anymore. It's really great service, beautiful ships, fantastic dining, pretty all inclusive for the most part. Yeah. So. That one continues to blossom.
So we asked Sue Kelly. I'm glad Steve's chiming in here because I don't know people who know more about travel than the two of them. Destin, Florida. We just asked Sue to give us five great destinations. Destin, Florida, Alaska, Egypt. How about that? River cruises. What's number one for you, Sue? What are you thinking about?
Okay, my drum roll. Coming back to Greece, John. Greece is everywhere.
No, Greece isn't Greece.
Well, it's not just Athens anymore. Although if you're going to Athens, you have to go to the New Acropolis Museum. It's unbelievable. You walk in over these plexiglass and you're looking down on ruins. And that's how you walk into the building. It's with the shadow, with the Acropolis right behind you. It's just amazing. But it's not just Athens. You know, there's always going to be Santorini, which is perhaps one of the most romantic places on Earth, and Mykonos for the nightlife. But we're seeing these smaller islands like Naxos. Naxos is a foodie hotspot. The island has, you know, they have great agriculture, and so they have kind of created their own food culture, and people are flocking there. And to Crete. Crete is another one, a little slower paced, very authentic. And we're seeing there, mark my words, you're going to hear this over the next few years, this slow travel movement where people are starting to want to slow it down. They want a real authentic experience and culture and local people.
Oh, I like the sound of that, the slow travel movement.
Mark my words, you're going to hear about it.
I traveled with people, and if we come into a town, we'll meet them at lunch, and we'll say, what did you do? And they say, and they'll click off like seven things they did. And I'm happy for them because they're very energetic and they like going to these places and see that, do that, boom, 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 boom. And then there's some of us who think I spent the morning at a cafe, just having a cup of coffee. I'm somewhere in between. When I'm doing the one, I think I should be doing the other. And if I'm not doing enough, then, you know, I feel like I'm wasting this opportunity. So it's kind of hard to know how to spend your time. You know what I mean?
Right. Well, the whole thing behind that movement is really that let's stay in Crete for 5 days and let's slow it down. Let's not have such an impact on how we don't want to trample a town is really kind of what it comes down to.
Right.
But how can we really understand the culture and the local people? And that's by slowing it down and really kind of diving in a little bit deeper. And that's what slow travel is all about. It's maybe trying to remove some of that that footprint and being responsible good travelers.
Yeah. I want to just read some text. John, I love spending time on the North Shore of Minnesota, the city of Duluth with its tall hills. Work your legs, your calves. what a workout, but just spending time there was relaxing on the shores of Lake Superior. I've done that, and I agree. But a lot of you are just commenting on the obvious, and that's good. The Grand Canyon, the Tetons, Rocky Mountain National Forest, the Outer Banks of North Carolina, where Blackbeard the Pirate was captured. I think that's a terrific location, and that's a day's drive away, and that won't break the bank. A 10-day raft trip through the Grand Canyon on the Colorado, John. Our favorite place, another texter said, is Gettysburg and other Civil War battlefields. Just some suggestions. And one last note as I close with Sue Kelly from Kelly Cruises, and that is I'm leading a trip with 20-plus listeners, maybe 30 now. Brenda's coming along, too, of course. We're going to be starting in Istanbul and going through Santorini. Are we on Athens in this trip?
We are.
Ephesus, Dubrovnik.
Santorini, Catacalan, Corfu, and then we're going up, and I didn't get a chance because we only did five, but I would say that Kotor and Dubrovnik in the Dalmatian coast, hugely popular.
Yeah,
and then we're overnighting in Venice, which is, you know,
it's Venice.
It's Venice. It's an incredible destination.
KellyCruises.com to travel with us. It's nice to talk to you. Thank you, Sue.
Thanks, John. Take care.
That's
bye-bye.
KellyCruises.com and also SteveBertrandTravel.com if you travel with Steve. Or maybe you just do it on your own. G. Suki right now. What's coming up, G?
You won't believe it. This is shocking. This is shocking data.
All right.
I have not been blessed enough to be a mother, but a new mother in the U.S. on average will pay $4,500 for labor and delivery. And John, guess what? This is with insurance.
Oh, that was my next question. So that's out of pocket,
$4,500. Yes. That's with insurance.
Makes you think, I wonder what the total cost is. It must be over 10 grand.
I'm sure.
You're doing something about this in a little bit?
We're going to be talking with the doctor who was in charge of the study, and it came out of the University of Michigan, but I guess I can't even afford to have a baby.
Nobody can. If you wait, you never will. I'm not going to push you in this direction, but trust me, you'll never have them if you wait until you can afford it.
Gotta get a husband first, though.
Okay, you've got things to do.
Bye.